Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello, Buzzkillers. It's the old professor once again, alone, yet not alone. In the Buzzkill Bunker, we're lucky to have Professor Jonathan Rose of Drew University, author of a new book, The Literary Churchill, author, reader, an actor, recently out from Yale University Press. And I have to say, Professor, this is one of the best books I've read in a long time. I don't normally do late 19th and early 20th century British history, but it was absolutely gripping.
Well, I'm glad you found it entertaining.
Why did you concentrate? We need to tell the Buzzkillers, first of all, why the book is on the literary Churchill, this author, actor, reader thing. People might not realize how literary he actually was.
Yeah, it's one of the few aspects of Churchill's life that very few people have written about.
Right.
He was if he had never gone into politics, he would still be read today as an author because he simply was an incredible wordsmith. And he was very successful in his lifetime. He won the Nobel Prize in Literature. He made heaps of money. He published bestsellers. But beyond that, you can't understand his political agenda unless you understand what he read and what he wrote. Because in everything he did in politics, he followed a literary model. He sort of acted out on the public stage what he read about in novels or saw in plays or, made up in his own books.
Yes, and it's absolutely fascinating, and it busts a number of myths that we think about Churchill throughout the book and shows how, for instance, how careful he was, especially in his younger political career, to think things through with unimportant decisions and often to be making literary references in his head to the decisions he was about to make.
He did. Now, he could be impulsive. Mm-hmm. And in part because he did often use literary or dramatic models for his political career, especially the House of Commons in Britain. It's the greatest theater in the world.
Sure.
Anyone who's seen their debates knows that you really have to be a stellar performer, and he was. And he went to the theater almost every other night. He saw George Bernard Shaw. He saw Oscar Wilde's plays, Noel Coward's plays, and obviously used them as models for his own performance style.
Right, and he clearly practiced it.
Very much so. Even what he tried to portray as impromptu was, in fact, very carefully rehearsed.
Let's start off talking about his youth and young adulthood. I was amazed, first of all, the amount of reading that he does, and that he forms these political opinions young, but as I said before, he's not knee-jerk about it. He's running through his head different options for political choices later on in his young political life based on all the stuff he's read as a young man.
Absolutely. He started out as a conservative,
right,
but he read the American Muckrakers. Mm-hmm. He read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. He read A Study of Poverty in England by Sebom Rowntree. And his politics changed. He became something of a crusader. He switches over to the Liberal Party, and he becomes a crusader against poverty and a scourge of what would now be called crony capitalism.
Right.
So at that point, he's actually a man of the left, very much so.
Yeah, in fact, the part about crony capitalism is absolutely gripping in the book because he really, really hates them, the invective he's writing about.
Oh, yes, yes.
It's very strong. He says it's worse to be a crony capitalist than to be a lazy coal miner who doesn't want to work or that sort of thing.
Well, exactly. And in the early 1900s, the Conservative Party was considering adopting tariffs. Mm-hmm. And Churchill said that's only going to protect favored industries. And the lobbyists are going to buy politicians to get these favors. And that's one reason why he broke with the Conservative Party.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely, absolutely fabulous. And it is, I'd like to get to later on the show, one of the reasons he seems to go back and forth between parties. And as you say, was he the last Whig, which is another very important historical question. But may we move on to World War I? I thought the influence of his reading, especially his reading on technology and almost a weird reliance on H.G. Wells and cheap science fiction, technological gadgets seem to have an unbelievable influence on his thinking and his what he's saying in the cabinet about tactics and war policy.
Oh, he absolutely loved Wells. He read everything he published as soon as it came out. He thought that the Time Machine was equal to Jonathan Swift as a satire. And he was absolutely fascinated with the kinds of technology that Wells imagined, one of which was the tank. I mean, long before World War I, Wells had written a story, The Land Ironclads, which anticipated armored warfare. So when the war breaks out, Churchill, although he is First Lord of the Admiralty, begins research into what becomes the tank. I mean, not exactly his department. I mean, he's in charge of naval warfare.
Right, right.
But he realized this would be very valuable in trying to break through the stalemate on the Western Front. And when it's perfected, he writes to Wells and says, we've done it. We have built your land ironclads.
Right. Now, if I remember correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, the ironclads that Wells had talked about also had these kind of digging devices in front of them, and that was considered eventually something not to put in the final design.
Well, it's a good point, because during the Second World War, Churchill's back as First Lord of the Admiralty before he becomes Prime Minister, and he tries to design just that kind of digging machine. You might call it a kind of land submarine.
Right.
And his idea is it's going to burrow beneath the Siegfried Line and come out on the other side in Germany. They actually built a prototype, a huge monstrous machine, but apparently it worked. Well, then the Germans overrun France, and that's put pay to that idea. But you can see, once again, he's using Wells as a model.
And there are other things I noticed in planning the Gallipoli campaign. The number of things he brings up from his reading and his literary background in letters to friends, in talking to cabinet ministers, is amazing.
Yes.
But it's not just that. I mean, it's not as if Churchill is only wanting to go back and run another ancient war and become another ancient war hero. The way the Gallipoli campaign decisions are conveyed in this book is actually quite, you know, modern and strategic. It is not as bad an idea as people have been thinking in the last few decades.
Well, it was certainly modern.
Right.
And Gallipoli, in an odd way, is based not so much on what he read, but on what he wrote. He published a novel in 1899 called Savrola. It's terrible. But I can assure you it's one of the worst ever written. But it reveals a lot about the man. Now, it's Churchill's only novel because he couldn't construct a plot. And he'd write himself into a corner, you know.
Right.
Now, when he explained why the novel was a failure, he said it included a kind of Gallipoli. Well, in fact, the novel includes a naval assault on a city, which takes place somewhere in southeastern Europe, not too far from the actual Gallipoli. And of course, he'd written this 15 years earlier. The problem is, in the novel, the Navy has no ground support. They've got no ground troops, so they can't go anywhere. They can't capture the city. They can't, you know, and the story just comes to an end because Churchill couldn't see two steps ahead in the plot. Well, then in 1915, he makes exactly the same mistake. The first assault in Gallipoli had no, you know, ground troops.
Right.
And, several ships are lost to Turkish mines, and it's a failure. And they try again with ground troops. By that point, of course, the Turks have been forewarned.
And built up reinforcements.
And the British Commonwealth troops are simply bottled up on the beachhead. But you do see how he's following a kind of literary agenda in this military campaign, you know, in this case, to disaster.
Yes. Immense disaster. But then after World War II, there's a kind of period where he tries to go through a sort of literary and historical justification of the decision.
Yes.
He seems to write to close friends that, you know, oh, this is what we did this for certain reasons, and it would have worked if we had done it this way. It wouldn't have worked if we'd done it a different way. And it wasn't such a bad idea. It's just that the implementation didn't work.
Well, he does write a history of the First World War. It's
right.
called The World Crisis. It's six volumes. And another politician, Arthur Balfour, said it's a history of the universe with Winston as the hero. and it is, yeah, it's justification of Britain's role in the war, and specifically Churchill's role in the war. And certainly he twists things. Mm-hmm. He omits things. He puts his own spin on events. He was, in many ways, a brilliant historian, mm-hmm. but he frankly admitted, you know, you give me the facts and I'll twist them any way you want.
And he says that to the cabinet minister.
Maurice Ashley, who was one of his research assistants, right. So he starts with the narrative, the story, and then collects the data to prove his point. And, of course, the data can be highly selective.
It's funny how, though, the Gallipoli thing never, or his Gallipoli justification never really works. No one ever comes to the Churchill side of things. Most people and most historians think that Gallipoli was a very badly planned.
Today,
and it was Churchill's fault.
Yes, that would be the consensus of historians. But I think at Clement Attlee, the head of the Labour Party, mm-hmm. who was Churchill's arch rival and indeed also fought at Gallipoli, but actually thought it was a good plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly true. The Western Front was stalemated. The carnage there was terrible. The idea of doing an end run around Germany and her allies seemed superficially plausible. Make use of Britain's naval might.
Mm-hmm.
But fundamentally, the plan was flawed, and I don't think it could have succeeded.
No, and certainly not without the land troops there first or at the same time. We need to take a quick break and thank a couple of Kickstarter supporters. All of you out there know that we could have never gotten this show off the ground, I almost said off the air. I was thinking of the next H.G. Wells machine, without the support of all you Kickstarters. And this, I want to put a special thank you out there to G.T. Stone and Amy Polson. So thanks again very much, Kickstarters. You're the reason we're here. Now, Professor, we've got World War One finished, so to speak. We've got World War One justified in a Churchillian way,
yes,
right, and comments on that. And what about the interwar years? If we look back on his party political history, it seems to be fluid. How does literature affect that?
Well, he does move back to the Conservative Party simply because the Liberals are dying as a political force, and he has to go. You know, he has to go somewhere.
Right.
He never liked socialism, which is why he couldn't go to the Labour Party. He, even though he favored the welfare state in mm-hmm. many ways, he hated bureaucracy. He hated any kind of government controls. I think that was one reason why he became a writer, because he said a writer enjoys total freedom.
Right.
And he became a passionate advocate of press freedom and freedom of the press.
In fact, he said a writer could be the only free person because
he's
self-employed and all kinds of other, you know,
self-identity
things.
True. But given a choice, he felt he had to go back to the Conservative Party, even right. though in some ways elements of his old liberalism remained. For example, as early as 1909, Churchill said, look, if we're facing high unemployment, maybe the government should create public works to create jobs and stimulate the economy. Now, he was a Keynesian before Keynes.
Right.
At that point, John Maynard Keynes was a very conventional free market economist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after World War I, the British economy does go into the doldrums. There's chronically high unemployment. Keynes changes his mind and begins to advocate a deficit spending. Churchill becomes Chancellor of the Exchequer in charge of the Treasury. He reads Keynes. He is very tempted to embark on a policy like this, but he's warned by his fellow conservatives, don't do it, we won't support you. And he backs off and said it was the biggest mistake he ever made, that he should have, in fact, gone for a government stimulus, even at the mm-hmm. expense of running up deficits.
Yes, it would have been a very interesting intra-party tension in the conservatives, and then you've got Labour on the other side. Probably once Churchill became a public Keynesian, they might even be trying to coax him over
yes.
to their side.
Yes.
But as you said before, he's equally opposed to big-scale union control as he is to big-scale capital control.
Certainly, yes.
Well, that's absolutely fascinating. And of course, there's that famous quote where he says, if you're not a liberal at 20 and not a conservative at 35, you know, you don't have a brain, you don't have a heart. Didn't actually say that. But it is amazing that he bounces back and forth the other way,
right?
Really, sort of liberal conservatism. That brings us to the other big question of the interwar years as the next war starts coming up, and that is, of course, appeasement.
Yes,
and you show how very complicated and very diverse Churchill's thinking about Hitler and about appeasement mm-hmm. and about what to do is. In fact, I think it's the first time I've read this much detail on his thinking.
Yes, going back to his novel Savrola, which is, I say, not a very good novel. It's a novel about a Middle European dictator,
right?
Who is ultimately defeated by this brilliant orator, and I think that this was the kind of narrative that Churchill constructed for himself mm-hmm. 30 years before he's ever heard of Adolf Hitler.
Right.
So when Hitler appears on the scene, you know, there about 1930 thereabouts. Churchill immediately recognizes him as a threat and was indeed the first major politician to say this man absolutely has to be stopped. He was very consistent right. about that. Regarding appeasement, Churchill did say that appeasement isn't always a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, it's the right policy. In other cases, a war postponed is a war avoided.
Right,
and you can horse trade, you can compromise, you can defuse confrontations. Sometimes I think he himself would have said the Munich analogy has been overused. It's appropriate in some cases, but probably in the majority of cases not.
It'd be great to bring him back and have him say that during every presidential election that's happened in recent years. Because that
and he
almost
did, in fact, say it in his history of the Second World War.
Yes, that's right. So you could see a kind of, horse trading with Hitler that might have prevented a war that Churchill wouldn't have objected to if it had actually prevented the war. That's certainly a myth that our listeners need to have busted. Now, of course, it doesn't happen. War breaks out, and you have the Second World War chapter you call "The Finest Hours of War Poet." I think that's absolutely fascinating. How you argue that Churchill uses literature to craft his speeches and even to craft his policy.
Yes. First of all, he's always quoting poets, Kipling, Tennyson, in his speeches. If you look at the original scripts of his speeches, they are written in blank verse.
Yeah, so that's astonishing to me.
Well, it makes sense because it enables him to capture the cadences
right.
of poetry.
And he's acting it out.
Yeah. And acting it out on the stage. Moreover, another literary source he drew on was, as a young man, he loved Victorian melodrama.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what were the stage conventions behind Victorian melodrama, which is now obsolete as a theater form?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, there's always a battle between absolute good and absolute evil.
Right.
The hero is pure. The villain is absolutely depraved. Secondly, there's always a point in the play where the villain has the hero cornered. He's got his back to the wall. There's absolutely no way out. And this is the point where the hero should throw in the towel. But he delivers a speech, shaking his fist in the face of the villain and declaiming, I am going to fight for England or motherhood or whatever it is.
Right. And this is the same as the Agincourt speech.
Yes.
And the Battle of Britain speeches.
Yes, exactly. Right. Now, there's a term for this. It's a theatrical device. Oh. It's called claptrap. today claptrap means any kind of nonsense, but back then it meant this specific melodramatic stage device. And a very good example, yes, would be we will fight on the beaches, we will fight in the landing fields, in the cities, and so on. And Virginia Woolf, listening to this, recognizes it uses the word claptrap, but realizes it's very effective. Mm-hmm. Because what is it? Claptrap? It makes the audience clap. You are trapped into clapping.
Oh,
you see, it rouses the audience,
that's
certainly what it did in June of 1940.
I never thought of claptrap as possibly having a positive connotation.
Oh yes,
and then a you know mm-hmm. sort of tactical connotation. What else about his speeches in particular, because that's what his World War II speeches in particular, because that's what Americans especially really like to focus on and really like to quote, overquote, misquote,
yes,
play records of what, well, I shouldn't say records of, this. When I was a kid, people did that. But you know what I mean? It's always brought up whenever there's a threat and an evil dictator is always compared to Hitler, and Churchill quotes are then brought up ad nauseum, in my view.
Well, someone once said that Churchill was a great quarterback, a bad quarterback, but a great cheerleader.
Right.
and that his, if you look at the strategy decisions he made, there were many errors during the Second World War. He once authorized an attack on some islands in the Aegean that the Germans had occupied. Like Gallipoli, it could go nowhere. Right. It was making the same mistake all over again, and the Americans didn't support him, and it was a fiasco. But certainly in terms of maintaining morale, his speeches, I think, were vital to the British public. Mm-hmm. His interesting, the polls at the time showed he had an approval rating of 80-90% as prime minister.
Oh, right.
But if you rephrase the question and you ask the British voters, who are you going to vote for in the next election? Then the Labour Party consistently came out ahead.
Now, this is even in the middle of the war?
In the middle of the war.
Okay, because I used to tell my students it was near the end of the war that people started moving to Labour. So they're going for Labour in the
already,
middle of
they're
war.
Already doing that.
Well, that's fascinating.
And the reason was they recognize that Churchill is an effective war leader.
Right.
But they don't trust him to govern Britain in peacetime. And in peacetime, mm-hmm. they don't want rousing speeches anymore.
No.
They wanted basically a better life, a new deal for Britain, more welfare spending.
Right.
And that is why he lost his bid for re-election in 1945.
Right, right, which was a shock to many people. But when you read it, when you see it this way and you have it all laid out before you, and now that we know that public opinion had gone towards Labour so much earlier than I thought before, It's not a strange election at all.
It was entirely to be expected.
Yeah,
yes,
makes sense. That's interesting though, because as you say and as you point out earlier, several places in the book, he's not an anti-Keynesian. He's not an anti-welfare state.
No,
it's conservative at all.
Not at all. He supported. In the Edwardian years, he supported creating special boards to regulate sweatshops.
Yeah,
he was behind one of the first government programs, a limited program of medical insurance, health insurance. And in 1945, he did say, "Yes, we can provide more of a social safety net," but he felt that Labour went too far.
Right.
And that ultimately Britain was economically exhausted at the end of the war, couldn't afford all of that. And you might say in that sense he was right.
Yeah, and also it might have gone to the oligarchy of the Labour Party leaders,
yes,
of the union leaders.
Which he very much feared,
and
yes.
He's just as afraid of the oligarchy of the capitalists. So it's a very interesting election. Another interesting factor of Churchill's thinking and the way Churchill's thinking comes about is the way he views imperialism. Mm-hmm. Of course, is the image is he's the great imperialist, maybe the last great imperialist,
yes,
next to Macmillan. But this really isn't true once you start digging into all of, or it's not as true once you start digging into how his thinking it develops.
Yeah, he is an imperialist in the old 19th
yes,
century
yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Yeah, mold. Now, he does take seriously Britain's responsibilities to the native peoples.
Right.
And if they are mistreated, he's genuinely outraged. In 1919, there was a notorious massacre. A British general ordered to open fire on some peaceful demonstrators in India at Amritsar. Mm-hmm. And Churchill bucks his party and says, this is a horrifying, this is an outrage, and denounces it in no uncertain terms. The problem is that he had a paternalistic attitude.
Right.
Toward the Indians and the Africans. Yes, it's our responsibility to protect them. But if they start asserting themselves, that's insubordination.
Right.
And so he was deeply hostile to Mohandas Gandhi,
right,
who he felt was trying to undermine the British Empire. Curiously enough, and although he hated Gandhi, who was, of course, nonviolent, Churchill deeply admired the Mahdi. Now, the Mahdi, back in the 1890s, had led a Muslim fundamentalist revolt in the Sudan.
Right.
Okay. Churchill found him an absolutely fascinating character because, well, perhaps because he was a freedom fighter and just a tremendously fascinating literary character. Mm-hmm.
He had the military side to him that Gandhi, of course, never had.
Yes, and Church could understand that. If it was a strict fight between the British and the natives, and the natives were brave, well, yes, he could respect that. Mm-hmm. What he couldn't deal with, ironically enough, was nonviolent resistance, which simply wasn't playing the game.
Right, right. And again, that just shows a fascinating diversity of thinking throughout his career when it comes to imperialism. One of your last chapters, your next to last chapter, is called The Last Whig. Now, was he the last Whig, do you think?
In a sense, he was. Mm-hmm. The Whig historians generally believed that everything in history is getting better and better.
Right.
History is one long march from darkness and feudalism toward ever greater progress, democracy, and freedom.
And Whigs in the 19th century were often put policies forward that reforms.
They believe in progress, exactly.
Education reforms.
Exactly. Things are just going to get better and better. Churchill started out as a Whig, but by 1940s, he realized this is a terrible 20th century, as he put it. It has two world wars, genocides,
right.
And the threat of nuclear annihilation. And he came to the conclusion that, no, history might not be that long, long forward march. Yes.
We should also stress that Whigs would put forward social reform measures of certain kinds, but you could never call Whigs early labor unionists. They're nothing like that. They're much more. They'll go a certain distance and no further.
True, and in that sense, he actually was a Whig,
right.
Because he did believe in gradual incremental reform. But his, I think, the optimism that the Whigs had,
right.
He lost. And how could he not lose?
Well, and that's true for an awful lot of early 20th century people.
Right.
The first half of the 20th century. What was the rest of his post-war literary life like?
He published, of course, his six-volume history of the Second World War. It was a bestseller in the United States. It sold almost as much as the Kinsey Report when it came out. he wrote a history of the English-speaking peoples, also several volumes, also a bestseller.
Yeah, a really big bestseller in the United States, that one. Yeah.
And yes, it was. And I think his political objective is he really wanted to see a kind of reunion of the United States and the United Kingdom. He somehow felt that these two countries could coordinate, have a special relationship, that's his phrase, that they could ensure world peace and democracy. So how do you do that? You write a common history of the two nations and show how they're intertwined.
Right. And he did so successfully in two cases.
Yes.
Okay. Finally, in terms of the book, what were some of what you call the terrible ifs? In the last chapter.
Okay. Not only was Churchill inspired by what he read, so was John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And as a young man, Kennedy loved Churchill's books, read through all of them. Very much modeled his oratorical style on Churchill. If you listen to Kennedy's first inaugural address, it is full of Churchillian echoes.
Right.
Okay. And was always quoting Churchill.
And Kennedy writes a book called Why England Slept.
Yes.
And Churchill had written book.
Just a year before. It's called
While England Slept. Yes.
Both dealing with appeasement.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Now, one of the books of Churchill that Kennedy read was The World Crisis, His History of the First World War, in which Churchill tries to explain how could Europe have stumbled into this terrible Holocaust.
Right.
And he basically Churchill outlines a strategy for avoiding a world war. And he makes reference to a crisis in 1911 over Morocco, where Britain and France and Germany went right to the brink of war but then pulled back. All right, so what did they do right in that case? Churchill said you have to do three things in this kind of crisis. First of all, draw a red line. Make it clear to your adversary this is not to be crossed. Secondly, mobilize your forces, prepare for war. But third, give your adversary a face-saving way of backing out.
Right.
Okay. So what does Kennedy do during the Cuban Missile Crisis? Well, he draws a line in the sand, goes on television, and says, we're not going to allow missiles in Cuba. Secondly, he prepares for an invasion of Cuba. But then third, he strikes a deal, appeasement if you want to call it that, with the Russians, removes our missiles from Turkey if they'll remove their missiles from Cuba.
But make sure that that part isn't announced publicly.
Until later, play that down.
Schlesinger comes out with it a couple of years before in the book later.
Right. But clearly, Kennedy was following Churchill's playbook there.
Well, we can't say that didn't work.
It did.
It certainly worked very well.
It did.
Yeah.
And there again, we have Churchill saying a war postponed may be a war avoided, which in this case is true.
And a nuclear war.
Yeah.
In that case. We have to take another ad break, our final ad break, and advertise one of our favorite Epicast shows. We're very proud to be on the Epicast Network, and we're also very proud to be big fans of the show Marta on the Move. So, Marta, take it away.
Hey, guys, this is Marta from Marta on the Move. I hope you're enjoying this podcast. When you're done with this one, you should go check out mine on www.martaonthemove.com. On the Epicast Network, you can find me on Twitter at @ICan'tFindMarta. If you like interesting people and places in Pittsburgh, food and drink, travel advice, and general nerdery, check it out and keep it moving.
Well, Professor, I'd be an idiot not to take the opportunity to get you to play our famous game, Churchill Quote or No Quote. It's sweeping the nation. It's very, very popular. It works like this. We have lots of quotes that are either Churchillian or they're not, and we ask our guests to put a bet down, so to speak, on whether the quote is from Churchill or not. You ready for the game?
Ready.
You're all set?
Oh, yeah,
okay.
All set.
Now, we have, obviously, I've dragged all the way to New Jersey here. I've dragged the Churchill quote or no quote wheel, and we're going to spin that in a minute. But here's the quote. It's better to jaw-jaw than war-war. Now, of course, in Churchill's accent or British accent, it would be war-war with the dropped R's. Is that a quote or no quote? I'm going to wait. Let me spin the wheel first. Okay. Go ahead and place your bet.
Can I bet on almost?
Oh, that might be. There is a slice. Oh, I should have shown you on the wheel before I started sprinting. There is a slice called almost, yes?
Okay, okay.
You're going for almost.
Almost,
or
yeah.
Or maybe.
Yeah,
all
yeah.
Right.
No, it's okay.
Okay, I'm going to go for no because it so often is no. Okay, the wheel is now slowing down, thankfully, slowing down. And you're absolutely right. It is almost, or maybe.
Yeah, John F. Kennedy used this, you know, quoted Churchill, but actually slightly misquoted him, saying jaw-jaw is better than war-war. He took that from Harold Macmillan, the British Prime Minister, who
60s.
Said he was quoting Churchill. But again, it was not exactly accurate. What Churchill actually said at the White House, by the way, in 1954 was, meeting jaw to jaw is better than war. That was the exact quote. So they got close, but not exactly.
Right. As with so many Churchill quotes, especially when they show up on motivational posters, they're made more pithy or shortened.
Yeah.
I have actually that at the remarks were at that White House luncheon in 1954, but no one knows exactly what they were because the meeting and the luncheon were closed to reporters. Word came out, and it was quoted in the Times, New York Times headlines, Washington Post headlines, and on and on and on and on and on. So clearly, you know your Churchill quotes better than I do, which is not surprising at all.
Well, it's a fun subject to study.
Yes. Well, it's been wonderful having you on the show, Buzzkillers, I highly recommend The Literary Churchill by Professor Jonathan Rose, subtitle Author, Reader, and Actor. It's on the Buzzkill bookshelf on our homepage. Make sure to click on it, and it's one of the best Churchill books you'll ever read. Trust me. Thank you again, Professor Rose.
Thank you very much, Professor.
And thank you, Buzzkillers. Over and out.